Boy, y'all must have been tired, her mama said. What were you expecting to hear, mama? Christine asked her. The bed spring squeaking? Thankfully, her parents' house had thick walls. Hey, Christine was in for a rude awakening when we arrived in Louisiana. I told her she was going to meet my family at a get-together at my brother Harold's house in Ruston, Louisiana. I don't think she realized she was going to meet my entire family. It wasn't like, hey, meet Mama and Daddy. It was more like, hey, meet my entire family and all of the in-laws. My grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and second cousins were there, along with practically anyone else who had a spot on our family tree. Christine is a very shy person, and she was worried about meeting my parents, let alone everyone else. There were more than 20 people at the impromptu reunion. She was really taken aback at how loud and competitive we were while playing games like dominoes and solitaire. She barely spoke a word the entire day. Not that she had much of a chance to say anything. Hey, welcome to the Robertson family. Fortunately, Christine won over my mama pretty easily. She actually wrote my mother letters thanking her for me. Christine thought she had gotten the best of the bunch of mama's boys. Was there ever any doubt? In our first year of marriage, Mama told Christine how happy she was that I'd married her. Mama thought Christine was the perfect wife for me. I was really happy Mama liked her. In April 1971, Christine and I moved to Junction City, Arkansas, which is where Phil and Kay were living at the time. It was during Phil's struggles with alcohol and drugs, so it was really a wild time to be around him. As I said earlier, I quit drinking alcohol shortly after I came back from Vietnam. Once I met Christine, I stopped drinking altogether. But Phil was operating a honky-tonk and was drinking all the time. Christine did not like Phil very much in the beginning. In fact, she despised it when I went hunting or fishing with him, which was usually every day. She didn't like the fact that Phil was taking other women on his fishing and hunting trips while he was married to Kate. Phil was my big brother, and I still loved him. But it was very difficult for me to see him go through his struggles. To be honest, Phil was not a very good person until he found Jesus Christ when he was 28 years old. But he repented his sins and is spending the rest of his life sharing God's word. Much to my surprise, I had a difficult time after I left the military. When I was in Vietnam, I couldn't wait to get back to the United States. When I was in Massachusetts, I couldn't wait to get back to Louisiana. But once I was closer to home and around my parents, brothers, and sisters again, I was bored out of my mind. I was different from a lot of guys in the military. I put a uniform on every morning when I went to work, but I took it off when I came home. It was more of a job to me than a career. But I liked that I had a lot of free time in the military, which allowed me to hunt and fish. After we moved to Arkansas, I worked a 9-to-5 shift in a particle board factory, and I didn't make much money. I was usually too tired to do the things I liked doing in the outdoors. In August 1971, Christine and I moved to Ruston, Louisiana. For whatever reason, I decided to go back to school on a GI Bill, which paid my tuition and helped pay for our living expenses as long as I was in college. I took classes at Louisiana Tech University. The administration was more than happy to welcome back one of its honor students, and worked from 3 o'clock to midnight 5 days a week. I worked in a broom factory for about 2 months, but then the owner fired me because his nephew needed a job. Since I was married, I needed a job to support my wife. The GI Bill didn't cover everything. Fortunately, the Ruston Police Department was looking to hire a radio operator. Back then, there was no such thing as 911, at least not in Ruston, so I was in charge of handling all the emergency calls at night, as well as being a dispatcher for the police officers who were on patrol. You wouldn't believe some of the calls we received. One time, a guy called me and told me his wife was in labor. Her contractions are only 2 minutes apart, he said. Is this her first child? I asked. No, you idiot, this is her husband, he told me. Hey, another time a guy called me from a payphone and told me he was having trouble breathing. Sir, where are you located? I asked. I'm at the corner of West Kentucky Avenue and South Chautauqua Road, he said. Are you asthmatic? I asked. No, he replied. Well, what were you doing when you started having trouble breathing? I asked. Running from the police, he said. It didn't take me long to realize I didn't want to pursue a career in criminal justice. It wasn't very long before I started losing interest in attending college, too. I was enrolled at Louisiana Tech for more than a year, but I just couldn't see myself staying in college for 3 more years. 5 days a week, I was attending classes in the morning, working at night, and studying before and after I went to work. Hey, I figured out I was working a lot less and making a lot more money when I was in the military. Before too long, Christine could sense my frustration. I'm not an angry person and really don't have much of a temper, but she could see that I wasn't the same happy-go-lucky guy I was when I was in the Army. One night after work, she sat me down in our living room. Are you happy going to school and working at night? She asked me. No, not really, I said. Well, I have a question, she said. Were you happier in the military than you are here? Yeah, I really enjoyed the military, I said. Well, why don't you go back into the Army, she said. In November 1972, Christine and I drove to the Army recruiter's office in Shreveport, Louisiana. They agreed to take me back, and I enlisted that same day. When I signed my contract to go back into the Army, I made the recruiter specify that I would spend at least 16 months at Fort Knox, which is about 35 miles from Louisville, Kentucky. I figured Fort Knox was pretty close to Christine's parents, and it would also ensure that the Army wouldn't send me back to Vietnam or another foreign country. Uncle Sam kept his word. We stayed at Fort Knox for 16 months. On the first day of the 17th month, I got my orders to go back overseas.
This is just the icing on the tip of the iceberg.
Chapter 22, God's Blessing. One of the first things I did when I arrived at Fort Knox, Kentucky, was make an appointment for Christine to see a fertility doctor. The military doctor started working with us in December 1972, and he eventually told Christine that he could fix it to where she wouldn't experience any more pain, but he still wasn't sure if we could have children. A few years earlier, Christine had been diagnosed with Asherman syndrome, which is a rare condition that causes scarring on the uterus. More than 95% of her uterus was covered in scars. The condition can cause infertility and miscarriages and is sometimes very painful. When Christine was working, she often missed at least a couple of days of work every month because she was in excruciating pain. Christine had surgery in July 1973 to remove the scarring from her uterus. Fortunately, the procedure eliminated her pain, but we still weren't sure whether we could have children. The doctors told us to keep trying to get pregnant for a year, and we had to closely monitor when she was ovulating. Well, nothing happened in the first 9 months after her surgery. The doctors thought everything was fine with Christine, so they wanted to examine me to see if everything was okay. Hey, I didn't want to go see a doctor. Doctors and I go together like peanut butter and Dijon mustard. We don't get along, Jack. I remember when Mama took me to the doctor for the first time because I was having trouble with my eyes. For a few weeks, everything was really blurry and I was bumping into walls, tables, chairs, dogs, grizzly bears, and anything else that was in my way. Mrs. Robertson, your son needs to stop drinking iced tea, the doctor said. It's bad for his vision. Hey, I love iced tea, I said. I don't care if I go blind. I'm drinking tea, Jack. Well, at least take the spoon out of the cup before you drink it, he said. Christine was ready to have a baby, so she really wanted me to visit the doctor to find out what was going on. I wanted to have children badly as well, so I agreed to go. After an examination, the doctors thought my sperm count might be low. They handed me a glass jar and told me to bring back a specimen the next day. Now, I'm not going to lie. I didn't feel comfortable doing it. Despite my embarrassment, I agreed to come back with a specimen. The next day, I returned to the doctor's office. "Where's the sample?" the doctor asked me. "Hey, I tried to do it," I told him, "but no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't do it. I asked my wife for help, but I still couldn't do it. Then I asked my neighbor to help me, and I even asked my army buddies for assistance. No matter who helped, I couldn't do it." I looked at the doctor, and his face was bright red. "Hey, none of us could get the lid off the jar," I said. We found out that my sperm count was very low. Hey, they were grade A sperm, but there weren't enough of them. The doctors discovered that my body temperature was too warm because I was always wearing tight shorts, kind of like the low-cut ones football coaches used to wear on the sideline. I like to wear them because they really showcase my legs. To fix the problem, I started wearing boxer shorts and sweatpants. Christine and I went back to trying to have a baby. In April 1974, when my 16-month enlistment at Fort Knox was about to expire, the Army notified me that I was being deployed to Baumholder, Germany. The Baumholder post was an old Nazi garrison located in southwest Germany, just east of the French border. Before World War II, the Nazis displaced hundreds of families to build a military training ground that covered nearly 30,000 acres. During World War II, Baumholder was also the site of a prisoner of war camp that housed prisoners from the Soviet Union, Poland, and other countries. In March 1945, Baumholder surrendered to the Americans without a fight, and it became a French military outpost. In 1951, the U.S. Army took over the outpost and built schools, houses, churches, and warehouses for more than 4,000 troops and their families. Until recent military cutbacks, Americans outnumbered the Germans living in Baumholder by nearly 3-1. It really was a beautiful area. Rolling hills surrounded Baumholder, and it had bars, dance halls, and music halls from its medieval roots. It was located in the middle of Germany's wine country, in Austria, Belgium, France, Holland, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and the Bavarian Alps were within a few hours' drive. Hey, it was a lot different from Louisiana and Vietnam. I left for Germany in May 1974, and Christine joined me there about 3 months later. In December 1974, Christine became very ill. She thought she had the flu. Sharon Sawyer, the woman living next door to us on the military base, encouraged her to take a pregnancy test. "I know I'm not pregnant," Christine said. "There's no need to go." "Do it for me," Sharon told her. "Please do it for me. You never know." Sharon persuaded Christine to go to the military hospital and take a pregnancy test. Later that day, Sharon asked her to call the hospital to find out their results. "I'm not even going to call," Christine told her. "I know I'm not pregnant. I know it's going to be negative." Without Christine's knowing, Sharon called the doctor's office and pretended to be her. After a few minutes, Christine heard her say, "What do you mean, do I want to keep the baby? Of course I'm keeping the baby." Sharon walked into the living room of our apartment and shouted, "We're pregnant! We're pregnant!" When I found out Christine was pregnant, it was one of the happiest days of my life. I always knew if God wanted us to have children, He would make it happen. If He didn't want us to have kids, we wouldn't have them. I have always left those kinds of things up to the Almighty, and I've always known I've had no control over them. When I first asked Christine to marry me, she told me, "No, I won't marry you. I've seen you around children, and you love them. You need to have kids. You want to have kids." Even though I would have been perfectly happy adopting kids or living with Christine without them, I'd always wanted children of my own. I loved being around Phil's boys when they were babies, and I really wanted a chance to spread our love with children of our own. As it says in Psalms 113:9, "He settles the childless woman in her home as a happy mother of children. Praise the Lord." Hey, The next 8 months were the most anxious days of my life as I waited for my baby to arrive.
We're fixing to have a hoot, Nanny, like you ain't seen in your lifetime.
Chapter 23, Tresa. One of the happiest days of my life was August 30, 1975, when my daughter Tresa Robertson was born at a military hospital in Landstuhl, Germany. After going through so many struggles to have a child, Christine and I couldn't have been more excited. We named Tresa after Christine's father, Asa Lee Rainey, and she actually has dual citizenship because she was born in Germany while I was stationed there. From the time Tresa was born, she was Daddy's girl. When Tresa was old enough to crawl, she sat in the foyer of our house every day waiting for me to come home for lunch. She'd sit in my lap while I ate, and then she was waiting in the foyer again at the end of my work day. Her eyes lit up every time I walked in the door, and I don't know that I've ever seen a more beautiful sight. When Tresa was only a toddler, Christine and I realized that she was an exceptional child. She was an absolute angel until she was 3 years old, but then she turned into a little devil. Christine took her to the pediatrician on the military base, and the doctor talked to Tresa without her mother in the room. The pediatrician came out and told Christine to put Tresa in preschool because she was bored to death. We put Tresa in preschool for 2 hours a day, and it really made a difference in her behavior. Tresa could read before she went to kindergarten. Hey, I told you my stock was grade A. One day in preschool, the teacher told the class something that wasn't factually correct. My 3-year-old daughter stood up and said the right answer. Needless to say, the teacher didn't like being corrected by a toddler. Tresa was always a very curious child. When we lived in Germany, I still liked to go squirrel hunting. I'd kill 5 or 6 squirrels and bring them home to cook. Tresa was probably only 5 years old at the time, but I had her hold the squirrels' legs while I skinned them. As I was gutting the squirrels, she would always ask what the organs were. "What's that?" she asked. "That's his kidneys," I told her. "What's that?" she asked again. "That's his heart," I said. She was fascinated by the anatomy of a squirrel, while most girls her age would have been completely grossed out. Squirrels are my favorite game to eat, and Tresa loves eating them too. When she started dating her future husband in college, they were sitting on a park bench watching squirrels run around in the grass. "Oh, I'd love to have a rock and hit them and then take them home and cook them," Tresa said. Tresa's boyfriend looked at her like she was nuts and asked, "What are you talking about?" "That's the best meat you'll ever eat," she told him. "Hey, that's my girl. She's a chip off the old block." When Tresa was 8 years old, a military psychologist on the base tried to tell us how to treat her because she was so intellectually gifted. But we wanted our daughter to be normal, so we treated her like any other kid. To this day, Tresa thanks us for not treating her like she was different. When Tresa was growing up, if Christine or I needed to punish her, we would take her books away. She always begged us to take away something else, like the TV or dessert, but we took her books away because we knew how much she loved to read and learn. Eventually, we even had to put a time limit on how long she could read. If Tresa didn't have a book in her hand, we thought something was wrong with her. Sometimes I would ask her, "Hey, why don't you have a book in your hand? Are you sick?" Because Tresa was so intellectually gifted, she never had many friends growing up. In fact, she was very isolated and kind of a loner until middle school. But then Tresa made 2 friends in the 6th grade, and the girls made a world of difference for her. One of the girls knew how to wear makeup, and Christine asked her to teach Tresa how to use it. The girls went shopping together, and Tresa started buying clothes that the other teenagers were wearing. She never worried about her appearance as much as she did about her brain. More than anything, those girls taught Tresa how to be a teenager. Along the way, I learned that raising a teenager is about as hard as trying to nail Jell-O to a tree. I tried to do the best I could do and offered Tresa and her friends advice whenever they needed it. Hey, I'd rather they learn from me than from their friends or somebody on TV. I remember one of the girls' mothers asking me if I minded her daughter being at our house all the time. Hey, I better ask you this. Do you mind her being over here all the time? I said. Because if they bring up a topic, there is nothing taboo in this house. If they want to ask me about sex, I'm going to tell them how it is. One night, I warned the girls about the dangers of drinking alcohol. I called the three girls into our kitchen, where I filled one glass with water and another one with whiskey. Then I placed a worm in each of the glasses. The worm in the water lived, while the worm in the whiskey shriveled up and died. What does that tell you? I asked them. Well, I won't have worms like a dog if I drink alcohol, Tracy said. It wasn't exactly the lesson I was going for. Sometimes Trace's sleepovers didn't go so smoothly either. One night, Christine left me with a handful of 10-year-old girls while she went to a friend's house to play bridge. Whatever you do, do not let these girls leave this house, Christine said. A couple of hours later, one of Trace's friends came downstairs. I need to go home, she said. Nope, you're not going anywhere, I told her. Go back upstairs. A few minutes later, the girl was standing in the living room again. Mr. Robertson, I really need to go home, she said. I was supposed to be home an hour ago. Hey, I'm under strict orders from headquarters, I said. Nobody leaves this house. About an hour later, there was a knock at the front door. It was a lady who lived down the street. Is my daughter here? She asked. Nope. I said, I haven't seen her. Then the little girl stuck her head around the corner. Mama, I've been trying to come home, she said, but he won't let me leave. In October 1992, the Army transferred me back to the United States. Tracy was in her senior year of high school, and we made the difficult decision to leave our 17-year-old daughter with co-workers and friends in Germany. I didn't want to be away from my daughter for a year, but I knew it was the best thing for her. We'd always talked about what happened to me during my senior year of high school when my parents moved from Dixie, Louisiana to Gonzales, Louisiana. I had to move schools during the middle of my senior year and graduated with people I didn't know. I was determined not to do that to my children. We talked to Tracy about it, and she understood the situation and was very grateful we were leaving her behind. It was a very long year without her. Tracy was attending Zweibrücken American High School in Zweibrücken, Germany, which was located on a United States Air Force base. The school also served the children of troops stationed at two nearby Army facilities. It was an exceptional school, and she received a fantastic education. When Tracy graduated from high school in 1993, she received a presidential scholarship to Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. In high school, she was named a student delegate to the United Nations and visited The Hague in the Netherlands. As a National Merit Scholar, she was invited to the White House in Washington, D.C., where she met First Lady Hillary Clinton. We couldn't have been more proud of her. She also excelled at Texas A&M. During Trace's sophomore year of college, one of her close friends was working as a fashion model. She invited Trace to attend one of her photo shoots, and the modeling agency became interested in Trace. She eventually became a model in advertisements around the country. I was so happy for her. Until Trace was 15, she never felt like she was pretty. But she really blossomed by the end of high school. As a child, Tracy wore Coke bottle eyeglasses. When Tracy was 8 years old, we were told she would probably be blind by the time she was 21. I told her we wouldn't worry about it and God would take care of everything. It was a hereditary condition. Christine's father was legally blind in one eye until he had laser surgery when he was much older. Fortunately, Trace's vision gradually improved, and she was able to wear contact lenses by the time she was 15. Trace graduated from Texas A&M in 1997. She took a year off from school between her junior and senior years because she was starting to get burned out. She spent a year working as a model and waitressing and really enjoyed it, then returned to Texas A&M the next year to finish her bachelor's degree. She was offered a scholarship to attend law school at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, but turned it down. She had other plans for her life. Trace met her future husband, Kyle Coburn, during her freshman year at Texas A&M. He is 9 years older than Trace, and they've been married for 17 years now. Kyle is perfect for our daughter, and that's really all any parent could ever want. Trace now has 4 sons, Brady Silas, Caden, Jackson, and McCray, and she absolutely loves being a mother. She teaches middle school in Hurst, Texas, and loves what she's doing. I couldn't be more proud of and happy for her. Looking back now, it's amazing how much the good Lord has blessed us. For the first 4 years of our marriage, Christine and I weren't sure we could have children. But as I said earlier, I put it in God's hands. I knew I had to have faith in the Lord. As it says in Matthew 21:21, Jesus replied, "Truly I tell you, if you have faith and do not doubt, not only can you do what was done to the fig tree, but also you can say to this mountain, 'Go, throw yourself into the sea,' and it will be done." A couple of months after Tracy was born, Christine returned to her doctor for a routine checkup. She asked him if we could have another child. "If I'd seen you before your first child, I would have told you that you could never have children," he said. "If you had one, I don't see why you can't have another one." I knew if the Lord wanted us to have another child, then Tracy would soon have a brother or sister.
You can't tell by looking at me, but I'm a comedy man.
Chapter 24. Like Father, Like Son. Christine wasn't pregnant for 10 days before she started having problems with our second baby. I like to joke that our son, Scott, was trouble before he was even born. Scott was born at a military hospital in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, on December 18, 1977. After we returned to the United States from Germany in July 1977, I was stationed at Fort Lee, which is near Petersburg, Virginia, and Christine and Tracy went to stay with her parents in Kentucky. When the Army transferred me to Fort Polk in Leesville, Louisiana, in September 1977, Christine's parents brought them down to live with me. 2 weeks later, Christine started having serious problems. One morning, I woke up to go squirrel hunting. Hey, it was the first time I'd been back in Louisiana in a long time, and I couldn't wait to go shoot the long-tailed critters. But for whatever reason, Christine didn't want me to go hunting. "Why not?" I asked her. "I don't have a reason," she said. "I just have a feeling that you're not supposed to go." "That's not good enough," I said. "I'm going to shoot me some squirrels." When I came home from hunting, I found a note on our front door. Christine was at the hospital because of complications from her pregnancy, and Tracy was down the street at the preacher's house. Doctors told Christine there was a serious problem with her pregnancy and broke the devastating news that her fetus would probably die. But a month went by and Christine didn't miscarry, so the doctors took another ultrasound in October 1977. The fetus was still alive, and the doctors decided that when Christine was 7 months pregnant, they would hospitalize her until our baby was born. On the day after Thanksgiving Day, 1977, Christine was admitted to the military hospital at Fort Polk, where she was supposed to stay for the next 3 months. But on December 8, 1977, Christine started having contractions. The next day, she was flown to San Antonio because there was an experimental drug there that doctors believed might be able to stop her contractions. Our baby wasn't due until February 5th, 1978. If the baby was born in December, there was a good chance he wouldn't survive. On December 17th, Christine started hemorrhaging and doctors couldn't stop the bleeding. They delivered our son, Scott, the next day. I was at Fort Polk when Christine started hemorrhaging and the doctors called me and told me I needed to jump on the next flight to San Antonio. When I walked off the elevator at the hospital, I saw Christine walking down the hall. I looked at her and figured she hadn't delivered the baby yet. "I've already had the baby," she said. "Come on, let's go down and see him." "Hey, get out of here," I said. "You haven't had the baby." "Trust me," she said. "I had the baby. Let's go see your son." Scott was in critical care because he was 7 weeks premature. You couldn't really see him because there were so many tubes and wires sticking out of him. For years, Christine joked that Scott was the ugliest baby she'd ever seen. When Scott was born, Christine kind of went into a shell because she was convinced he wouldn't survive. It was a very scary time for us. The doctors told us the biggest factor on Scott's side was that he weighed 5 pounds, 13 ounces when he was born. Even though Scott was born nearly 2 months premature, he was still a pretty good-sized baby. When Scott was only 3 days old, I left to spend the night at a friend's house. Before Christine went to bed, she liked to go down and see him in the neonatal intensive care unit. She liked to rub his stomach and tell him she loved him. But on the third night, she walked into the ICU, and the nurses told her she needed to go back to her room. All of the nurses were around Scott. She knew something was wrong, so she called me and told me to come back to the hospital. Before I got to the hospital, doctors operated on Scott because his liver wasn't functioning properly. His bilirubin levels were critically high, and the doctors didn't discover the problem until he was 3 days old. Bilirubin is a brownish-yellow substance found in bile. It is produced when the liver breaks down old red blood cells. Bilirubin is then removed from the body through feces and urine. When bilirubin levels are high, jaundice causes a baby's skin and the whites of its eyes to turn yellow. Scott was given a blood transfusion, and thankfully the Lord healed him. When I arrived at the hospital that night, a doctor apologized to me for operating on my son without my permission. "Hey, did he need it?" I asked. "If we hadn't operated on him, he would have died," the doctor said. "Then no apology is necessary," I said. Well, we found out a few years later that Scott's high bilirubin levels had damaged part of his brain. Scott was suicidal from the time he was about 5 years old. His behavior was really erratic as a child. When Scott would get tired, he would throw his arms out and fall backward. When we were hunting hogs in Germany one time, Scott fell on the ground, which concerned the Germans who were hunting with us. "Hey, he does that all the time," I told them. Scott would fall down wherever we went. He did it in stores, in school, and while we were walking down the sidewalk. I never realized my son had serious problems. I don't know if I'm hard-headed, I'm stubborn, or I just wanted to overlook it, but Christine kept telling me Scott had real problems. "Well, hey, then I had problems too," I said. "All kids have problems." It took me a while to realize Scott needed help. When Scott was angry, he was out of control and did a lot of damage. The tipping point came when he was 11 years old. He came home from school, and Christine could sense that he was very tense. His bedroom was his safe haven. He had to learn to never get angry outside of his bedroom. Well, Scott walked into his bedroom that day, closed the door, and proceeded to destroy everything. When it was finally quiet, Christine went into the room. Scott was getting ready to jump out a second-story window. I don't know if the fall would have killed him, but it was straight down. Christine grabbed Scott and pulled him back into his room. "I can't go on," Scott said. "I can't do it. I just can't. You're my mother. You're supposed to help me. Make the pain go away." It broke our hearts. Christine called the military hospital and we took him there the next morning. We met with a new military psychiatrist and Scott was his very first patient. The psychiatrist told us there was a new drug on the market, and he wanted Scott to take it. The psychiatrist diagnosed Scott with having an attention disorder, hyperactivity, and a behavioral disorder. The psychiatrist told us we wouldn't see the effects of the new drug for 10 to 14 days. But on the third day, Scott got himself out of bed and walked into the kitchen for breakfast with a big smile on his face. We didn't know who he was. From that day forward, Scott became a typical child. He never lost his temper and rarely had mood swings. He continued to see a psychiatrist until he was 17 years old, but he never had serious emotional or behavioral problems again. We eventually figured out Scott was suffering from Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. The military psychiatrist saved my son's life. There's no doubt in my mind that God had a hand in our finding the doctor who could control Scott's disorders. It was another example of God taking care of us. It always seemed like when we desperately needed someone to help us, like when we were trying to get pregnant, God pointed us in the right direction and put people in our lives who could fix our problems. As it says in Proverbs 3:5-6, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways submit to Him, and He will make your path straight." Eventually, Scott became a good student and graduated from Paint Rock Valley High School in Princeton, Alabama, in 1996. From the time Scott was a young boy, all he ever wanted to do was join the Army. Christine and I tried to talk him out of it and told him he could find a better career, but he wouldn't listen. Christine even pointed out things about the military he wouldn't like, such as authority and obeying orders. Even though Scott was a good student, he liked to argue with his teachers. We told him he couldn't argue with his superior officers in the military. We never thought the Army would accept Scott because of his medical history. When the military recruiters came to Scott's high school, he talked with representatives of the Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force. He didn't talk to the Army. As soon as Scott told the recruiters about his behavioral conditions, they told him he wouldn't pass the physical exams to join the military. We thought that was the end of it and Scott would find something else to do with his life. As soon as Scott graduated from high school, he left to visit Tracy in Texas. Scott called his mother about a week later and told her he'd enlisted in the Army. "I have one question," Christine said. "How did you manage that with your medical history?" "Don't ask, don't tell," he said. "Scott, that doesn't apply to your medical history," she said. "Well, they didn't ask, and I didn't tell them," he said. Scott joined the Army and went to basic training at Fort Jackson in Columbia, South Carolina, in November 1997. He completed advanced individual training at Fort Eustis in Virginia. It was the same exact training I had when I joined the Army. When Scott tells me things about the Army, it's like I'm reliving my experiences. He even had a superior officer named Doc, just like me. I always tell him, "Scott, didn't you learn anything? I always told you, don't be like your dad." Scott and his wife, Marcia, have four boys, Ethan, twins Connor and Logan, and Wyatt, and live at Fort Eustis. They had Wyatt in July 2013, giving Christine and me 8 grandsons. I'll have my own baseball team if Tracy or Scott has one more child. Ethan was Marcia's son from her first marriage, but Scott adopted him last year. Ethan was signing his name as Ethan Robertson at school, and his teachers kept telling him he couldn't do it. "Oh, yes, I can," Ethan said. "Scott Robertson is my dad." One night, Ethan asked Marcia what would happen to him if anything happened to her. "Well, Connor and Logan will stay with Scott, and Scott would have to go to court to get you," she said. "I don't like the sound of that," Ethan said. Last Christmas, Scott and Marcia wrapped a birth certificate with Ethan's name change and a duck call engraved with his new name and put it under the Christmas tree. Christine and I received another grandson that Christmas, and it was the best present of our lives.
Work hard, nap hard. Hey, that's what I always say, Jack.
Chapter 25. Sleepwalking. After Scott was born, we spent 4 more years at Fort Polk, where I worked with the 5th Aviation Battalion, which is an air ambulance detachment of helicopters. Hey, I learned that flying a helicopter is really no different than riding a bicycle. It's just a lot harder to put baseball cards in the spokes. My kids really liked living at Fort Polk, and I was happy to be back in Louisiana. But Christine was never very fond of the place. The base was located in the middle of a swamp, and the mosquitoes were bad. When Christine came to pick me up from work on the base one day, there was an alligator sitting in the middle of the road. That might have been the straw that broke the llama's back. In 1982, the Army transferred me to Zweibrücken, Germany. When we boarded a plane to fly to Frankfurt, Germany, Christine told me, "You'll never get me to live in this state again." I knew she was serious. I loved being closer to my parents, brothers, and sisters, but Christine was never very close to her siblings. Her family wasn't as close as mine, so she didn't realize how important living in Louisiana was for me. During the first 2 years we were living back in Germany, Christine became very depressed and was really battling her emotions. Scott was about 3 years old at the time, before we'd gotten him help, and I think Scott's problems were weighing on her mind. She felt guilty because she didn't know how to help him. She was always upset. I didn't yet understand the gravity of the situation. I don't think I wanted to accept that my son had serious emotional problems. I wanted him to be like every other kid. But Christine knew something was wrong with Scott, and she wasn't a very happy person for 2 years. Finally, I came home from work one day and told her, "Get help or I'm gone. I'm not going to live like this." After we both calmed down, Christine told me that whenever she pictured herself being old and gray, she thought of herself sitting in a rocking chair with me sitting next to her. Christine told me she couldn't see herself living without me, so she agreed to go to a psychiatrist to get help. In order to get the help Christine needed, she had to move back to the United States with our kids. In 1984, Christine and our kids flew back to the United States and moved in with Christine's parents in Kentucky. We shipped our furniture back with them, so I lived in the barracks on base. It was like I was in boot camp all over again, living like a bachelor in the military. Christine started seeing a psychiatrist, and thankfully the doctor was able to help her. During their sessions, Christine revealed that a relative had sexually molested her when she was younger. Christine never told her parents about it and internalized the painful memories for many years. Talking about her past and getting the issues out in the open really helped Christine. It was like a great burden had been lifted from her shoulders, and it helped me understand what she was dealing with. The psychiatrist told Christine that any relationship with God as its center has a better chance of being mended. We each knew we needed one another. As it says in Ecclesiastes 4:9-11, two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Christine wasn't the only one with problems when we were moved to Germany for a second time, although my issues seemed trivial in comparison. I was having a lot of problems at work. One of the colonels in Germany just didn't like me for whatever reason. For an entire year, I sat behind my desk and did nothing. I did not have a specified job, but I still had to show up for work every day. Somehow, I upset a bunch of my superiors by doing my job, so they took my job away from me. By exiling me to a desk, my superiors thought I would quit, request a transfer, or do something wrong that would enable them to get rid of me. But what they didn't know about Silas Merritt Robertson is that I'm perfectly content doing nothing. I showed up every day wearing spit-shined boots, a pressed uniform, and a big smile on my face. I kicked my feet up on my desk and rubbed it in their faces for 8 hours a day for 12 months. On most days, I put my head down and slept for a few hours. Hey, I can sleep anywhere. Look here, napping is just like hunting. If I walk through the warehouse when I'm at work, I look over, and there's the perfect spot. Boom, I'm asleep. I learned to sleep and ignore my surroundings when I was young. When I got past my bedwetting stage, I moved into the bedroom with my three brothers. There was always a lot of noise in the bedroom because there were four boys sleeping in the same bed. I never slept with a pillow over my head because I was afraid the fairies would take all of my teeth. Sometimes I slept in a sleeping bag on the floor. I was a human tortilla. I tried to sleep with an electric blanket one time, and I even plugged it into a toaster to make it warmer. But then I kept popping up out of bed all night. I've always loved to sleep. Hey, like I always say, work hard, nap hard. Napping is my favorite thing to do. In fact, I believe it should be our national pastime. Hey, when I'm napping, I might be dreaming about ducks, beavers, squirrels, Stevie Nicks, or anything else. When I'm asleep, it's just my mind and me. Everybody should take a nap once a day. It's a medical fact. Work, work, work. Nobody takes time to stop and smell the roses anymore. Hey, doctors have proven that daytime naps improve your memory and help you remember important facts. I guess that's why my mind is like Encyclopedia Britannica. Look, I've never had a problem falling asleep or staying asleep. When I was younger, I was asleep in my bed at my parents' log house. Phil was in the bed with me, and he heard something scurrying outside. Phil grabbed his rifle, opened the window, and laid the rifle across my chest to steady it. He fired a shot at a squirrel and missed. He missed the squirrel two more times, but I never woke up. Phil said I lay there snoring while he fired three shots out the window. When I was a little bit older, my sister Judy started dating when she was in high school. One night, Judy came home with her boyfriend, who was a football player at North Caddo High School. When Judy and the boy opened the front door to our house, I was standing in the living room looking right at them. I was sleepwalking. Then I bolted out the front door and took off running down the road. The boy realized I was asleep, so he took off running after me. He chased me for 2 miles before he caught me. The next day, the boy came to our house. He told me, "Man, I thought I was fast, but I couldn't keep up with you." It's amazing what some people can do when they're sleepwalking. There is a nurse in North Wales who draws and paints works of art while he's sleeping. A woman in England woke up one night at 2 a.m. and found her husband mowing the grass while he was naked. Tragically, an electrician in Wisconsin sleepwalked out of his house wearing only his underwear and a shirt and froze to death before he woke up. Hey, I do all sorts of things while I'm sleepwalking. I've run marathons, washed the dishes, vacuumed the house, cleaned my rifles, and prepared a big pot of gumbo. Christine never wakes me up when I'm sleepwalking because she says it's when I'm most productive. Hey, what do you call a sleepwalking nun? A Roman Catholic, Jack. Obviously, it didn't take the Army very long to figure out that I wouldn't have any problem sleeping through 12 months on the job. Fortunately, I was able to get back into the good graces of Uncle Sam when a new colonel was assigned to our unit. I was transferred back to the U.S. in 1985 and rejoined my family at Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Being reunited with Christine and my kids was one of the happiest days of my life, and I couldn't wait to climb into my own bed again.
These boys pack so much stuff. Hey, they could survive a zombie nuclear apocalypse.
Chapter 26. Mass Murder. One of the best things about being in the military is that I was able to hunt all over the world. I've hunted in Germany as well as Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, North Carolina, and Texas. Hey, you haven't hunted until you've sat in a deer stand with artillery shells firing over your head. That's exactly what happened to me at Fort Bragg, and it didn't take me long to find another deer stand, Jack. Believe me, it's a sound you'll never forget. When I was stationed in Zweibrücken, Germany, I had a buddy who was the hunting instructor for the area. If you were in the American military and wanted to hunt in Germany, you had to go through 8 weeks of classes to learn the German traditions and hunting regulations. Until you were certified, you weren't allowed to hunt there. When my buddy went back to the United States, he talked me into taking over as the hunting instructor. I couldn't speak German very well, but a lot of the local hunters liked me and allowed me to hunt on their land. Hunting in Germany was a little different than how we do it in the United States. Most hunting clubs in the U.S. lease land to hunt for ducks, deer, birds, and other game. But in Germany, you actually lease the animal rights for a certain piece of property. A lot of the hunters sold what they killed to restaurants to recoup some of the money they were paying to hunt. If an American soldier killed a deer or hog on someone's property, we had to pay the rights holder money to keep the meat. We hunted for roe deer, wild hogs, foxes, birds, and German hasen, or hares. German hunts were more like a big party. They were very big events, including an elaborate post-hunt meal and, of course, a lot of beer drinking. Sometimes I was in charge of bringing the noon meal. I usually had the mess hall cook a big pot of chili or beef stew, but sometimes I'd cook the Germans barbecued pork or another American dish. The first year I taught the hunting course, 7 Americans were in my class, and I took them hunting when the course was over. On our first hunt, 6 of the Americans killed a roe deer, which is a lot smaller than the deer we have over here. Roe deer typically weigh between 30 and 75 pounds, and they have reddish bodies with short, erect antlers. They're good to eat, but they're just not very big. Germany is about the size of Oregon, and they kill over 600,000 roe deer every year. They're everywhere. One of the great things about hunting in Germany was that it didn't get dark until about 10 o'clock at night. If you went deer hunting, you hunted all day long. On the first hunt, one of the Americans who killed a roe deer wanted to keep the meat, but he wanted me to clean it because he didn't know how. We paid for the deer and gutted it in the woods. By the time we got back to the apartment complex where I lived, it was close to midnight. "Well, it's late, and I don't feel like fooling with it tonight," I told him. "I'm going to hang it up in the basement." I tied a rope around a water pipe and hung the deer from the ceiling. I put a plastic tub under the deer so blood wouldn't drip all over the floor. It was cold in the basement during the winter time, so I decided to go to work the next morning and then clean the deer when I came home. Hey, when I came home from work the next day, there were 4 military police cars and another 5 German police cars sitting outside my apartment complex. There was even an emergency medical wagon sitting in the parking lot. "What in the world is going on?" I asked myself. When I walked up to my apartment, one of my neighbors told me, "Hey, there's been a mass murder in our apartment building." "Get out of here," I told him. "A mass murder? Hey, I'm serious," he said. "There's blood everywhere." Immediately, I ran to my apartment to make sure Christine and the kids were okay. They were fine, so I went back downstairs to see what was going on. I saw a German doctor I'd been hunting with the day before. "What's going on?" I asked him. "Oh, they found a roe deer in the basement," he said. "All of this for a roe deer?" I said. "What are you doing here?" "They called me here to determine the cause of death," he said. "Well, what'd you tell him?" I asked. "I told them it looked like a .30-06 to me," he said. You're exactly right, I said. Well, a woman in my apartment building had gone down to the basement that afternoon to do her laundry. She saw the deer hanging from the ceiling and freaked out. The crazy woman ran out of the basement screaming, "Mass murder! Mass murder!" Fortunately, I was able to talk my way out of the predicament. The police even let me keep the evidence. Hunting roe deer was a lot of fun because they would appear out of nowhere at any time. They're so small that they love hiding in tall grass. You would be walking through a field and roe deer would start popping up everywhere. One time when we were hunting, one of my buddies killed the first wild hog on the property in about 12 years. It was near the end of the day, and there were three of us hunting. I put one guy in the stand and told him he couldn't shoot anything but a fox or pig. The other guy and I went down to a different stand to find a deer. The guy with me hadn't been hunting before, and I kept telling him he was making too much noise. "Hey, you have to be still," I told him. "If you'll be quiet, we'll kill a deer in about 15 minutes. I'm listening to the deer eat corn right in front of us. When they're done eating corn, they're going to walk out here and eat some grass. Well, he never sat still, and the deer never walked in front of us. Right before dark, I heard